I do not support SB 192 in its current form. I still believe, though, that the Senate Finance Committee can make some changes.
Frustration builds over the competing oil tax proposals. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, companies exploring for oil in Cook Inlet are caught with permit violations.
The Army Corps is not being even-handed, and we're seeing industry come in and ignore the rules.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The standoff over Governor Parnell's plan to rewrite the state's oil tax regime has turned personal. In a letter to Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman late last week, Parnell referred to senators working on an alternative tax reduction plan as, quote, a group of hens in the barnyard. Later, he asked Stedman not to, quote, shoot explorers in the head while they look for new sources of oil. The letter was a comment on a speech Stedman had delivered to the Juneau Chamber of Commerce last week in support of a tax proposal the Senate is pursuing. Stedman saw the letter as entertaining and dismissed it, saying the subject of taxation is unrelated to chickens. But he didn't back down from the Senate's plan or the goal of a new tax plan.
There's certainly more substantive issues and we have time to address, but we're going to tomorrow kick off at 9 o'clock with industry. The three majors, Exxon, BP, and Conoco, will be testifying, and then we'll have PFC Energy the following day, our consultant, and we'll start working on alterations of the bill and continue to try to evolve that and solve as many problems as time will allow.
Parnell said the letter was a proportional response to Stedman's speech. In a press conference this afternoon, Parnell criticized the Senate for missing a self-imposed deadline of giving its bill, SB 192, to the House by last Friday. He was asked specifically whether he would veto the Senate bill.
I do not support SB 192 in its current form. I still believe, though, that the Senate Finance Committee can make some changes, and I believe, obviously, it's a Senate bill. The House can make some changes.
The bills from the governor and the Senate cut oil taxes in different ways. The governor's offers more significant reductions, and the industry is pushing for it. Parnell today pointed to production promises that have been attached to his tax regime. BP last month promised $5 billion in new investments if the governor's bill passes. The governor today announced a commitment by Armstrong Oil and Gas, a newcomer to the state, of an additional $9 billion in new investment.
Unless there are companies willing to step forward with money in exchange for a new tax regime, then you got to question whether the tax regime is worth implementing and whether it will create new business.
A letter from Armstrong Oil and Gas says it could cause the company to invest as much as $9 billion. Stedman said the state will need more investment than what BP has offered to get production to the million barrels a day goal the governor has set.
Although it might sound like a lot of money very attractive, but when you actually look at the funds that's needed, the investment that's needed to go after this incremental oil production, it's not going to do it.
Stedman says he anticipates the Senate Finance Committee will have the bill ready for a vote early next week. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced Monday two permit violations for seismic surveying activity around Cook Inlet. Buccaneer Energy and Apache Alaska are the two companies found to have been in violation of provisions of the Clean Water Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
At issue are the permits handed out by the Corps of Engineers on both sides of the inlet, both inside the Kenai city limits and near the village of Tyonek on the west side. In Kenai, a subcontractor for Buccaneer, Weems Geophysical, was conducting seismic tests in a wetland area when the Corps was alerted to unauthorized discharges relating to the small detonations set off to conduct the tests. Here's Corps of Engineers spokesperson Dave Carey.
When we learned that they were doing that, we contacted the company and recommended that they not do any additional work in waters of the United States. And they agreed to cease operations until we could determine what appropriate resolution for that unauthorized discharge was.
The resolution was an issuance of what are called after-the-fact permits and additional shot hole permits for the area. The permit violations were related to the Clean Air Act and the regulation of fill materials placed in wetlands. Kerry says this particular material is the same as what was taken out.
You know, they are putting some explosives in the ground to, you know, to set off to do the seismic work that they are seeking to do. But the material itself is not of high concern in terms of if it's contaminant or anything like that.
Across the inlet, Apache is doing similar seismic testing and found itself in violation of permits for another reason.
When folks need a core permit, there's also another law that comes into play called the National Historic Preservation Act.
Wait, historic what? Right. When conducting these operations, companies are also obliged to conduct archaeological surveys in order to protect what are called previously undiscovered cultural resources.
Well, in the case of Apache, there were previously undiscovered archaeological sites. For example, there were some Denaina Athabascan village sites that were discovered in unlikely places. You know, there were some sites that were previously known, and for those types of sites, you know, they're easy enough to mark on a map and try to avoid.
That was state archaeologist Dave McMahon. He works in the State Historical Preservation Office, one of many organizations companies have to work with when undertaking these projects. Lisa Parker is the manager of government relations for Apache. She says they're searching for those cultural resources throughout the process right up until the hole is drilled.
And the wilderness guides that were with the drill crews found four new sites that hadn't previously been identified. And we had already drilled in those areas because the archaeologists had cleared it, but then we found them, so we ceased operations.
But environmentalists aren't convinced that the standards and regulations in place are rigorous enough to fully protect environmental and cultural assets. Bob Shavelson of the watchdog group Cook Inlet Keeper says this is nothing new.
Historically, Cook Inlet has always been kind of a regulatory backwater because development in Cook Inlet preceded our major environmental statutes.
He says that playing catch-up in terms of regulation has allowed companies to disregard environmental and cultural impacts on a large scale.
To think that a company can go out and violate the Clean Water Act hundreds and hundreds of times and get a permit from the Army Corps after the fact and not get any fine for that, you wouldn't see a mom-and-pop operator that's building a parking pad and filling in a wetland getting that same treatment. So the Army Corps is not being even-handed, and we're seeing industry coming in and ignore the rules.
Even if regulations are behind, as Shavelson says, the developers are here now, and so is an appetite for more energy. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The former Exxon Valdez is headed to the scrap heap. As the 23rd anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill approaches, the tanker that ran aground in Prince William Sound and spilled millions of gallons of oil will be scrapped in Asia. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, the oil spill wasn't the Exxon Valdez's last incident, and this isn't the first time the tanker has changed hands.
The vessel, now known as the Oriental Nicety, sailed through some rocky waters during its time, but none were bigger than the disaster that occurred on March 24, 1989, when the then Exxon Valdez struck the Bly Reef, spilling 11 million gallons of oil into the Prince William Sound. Until the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, it was the largest spill in U.S. history. The incident caused over $3 billion in damages and led to the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. The law required owners to phase out single-hull ships. Now the vessel is heading to the scrapyard after a 26-year run. Maryland-based ship cash buyer Global Marketing Systems Incorporated says it was purchased by a Singapore company for $16 million. The deal is still being finalized. This isn't the first time the vessel has changed hands. After the oil spill, it was repaired and renamed the Exxon Mediterranean in 1990. The vessel was transferred to shipping subsidiary River Maritime Incorporated in 1993 as the Sea River Mediterranean. In 2007, it was converted to an ore bulk carrier and sold to Hong Kong Bloom Shipping. Under the name Don Fang Ocean, it was severely damaged after a collision with a Maltese cargo ship in 2010. It is unknown as to when it will make its final voyage to the scrapyard, which is in India. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
An environmental group has given notice it intends to sue the federal government for failing to prepare a recovery plan for highly endangered North Pacific right whales. Rebecca Noblin of the Center for Biological Diversity in Anchorage says a letter was sent yesterday to the National Marine Fisheries Service announcing the lawsuit plans. A 60-day notice is required before an endangered species lawsuit can be filed. The northern right whale has been listed since 1973. The Fisheries Service in 2008 published a rule listing North Pacific and North Atlantic right whales as separate endangered species. Noblin says in the letter that western stocks of North Pacific right whales has at most a few hundred animals, and the eastern stock that summers in U.S. waters has even fewer, about 30 whales. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the research phase of a mystery book gets interesting at the Anchorage FBI office.
And I run the plot by him, and he just sort of sits at me, staring, and he said, "We're really worried about that."
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Two women were rescued after a guided dog mushing trip went awry Sunday night in the White Mountains Recreation Area north of Fairbanks. Megan Peters is a spokesperson for the Alaska State Troopers. While details remain sketchy, Peters says both women were part of a four-member group that included three dog teams and a snow machine.
There were two guides and two clients, is my understanding of it.
48-year-old Peggy Billingsley of Fairbanks was a guide on the trip. She was stranded 15 miles from the Wickersham Dome trailhead with injuries and a severely wrecked dog team. The extent of Billingsley's injuries is unclear. Peters says it's also unclear what happened to her dog team. Billingsley was later transported to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital for treatment. The second woman is a 28-year-old from Georgia. She was reportedly stranded without adequate outdoor gear 7 miles from the trailhead.
That musher, when they located her, she was breathing, but she was not responsive. They transported her to the trailhead, where she was taken to the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital by EMS.
Trail groomers with the BLM spent some time Monday recovering equipment the group left behind. They also located and retrieved a dog that was separated from one of the teams. This is the second mushing accident in as many weeks. Troopers rescued a musher last week after he fell through some overflow in the Goldstream Valley. A leader in moving tribes to greater self-determination died over the weekend. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has this report on the life of Niles Caesar.
A Tlingit Indian from Juneau, Niles Caesar, served 20 years in the Medical Service Corps, including a year in Vietnam. He retired from the Navy as a lieutenant, then completed a bachelor's degree in environmental health. From 1979 to 1990, Caesar was executive vice president of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. For the next 19 years, he served as director for the Alaska Bureau of Indian Affairs. His colleague there, Charles Bunch, says Caesar headed the region after the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act opened the door for increased tribal self-determination and the transfer of responsibility for direct services from the agency to tribes.
Almost half of the recognized federal tribes in the United States are in Alaska, and Niles made great, great strides in helping them to contract out those government services.
Bunch says Caesar's push for self-determination carried through to his advocacy for a mainstay of Native life.
I think that the natives of Alaska have lost a champion as one of the members of the Federal Subsistence Board. I think Niles worked hard to ensure that way of life was continued in Alaska.
Caesar served on the boards of the Native corporations Sea Alaska and Gold Belt and was a council member on the Juneau, Tlingit, and Haida Community Council. He was a member of the Raven Moiety and Thluka Udi clan. Anchorage services will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday at the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. The family plans to announce Juneau services soon. Niall Caesar passed away Saturday at age 70 after a long struggle with cancer. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A senior official with the U.S. Department of Agriculture is touring Southeast Alaska this week. KRBD's Deanna Garrison sat down with the Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment during his visit to Ketchikan on Monday.
Butch Blazer has been on the job since October. This is his first visit to the country's largest national forest. Blazer says there are a number of important forest management and restoration issues on the Tongass.
I'm up here to learn, to gain a much better understanding of what is happening here in Southeast Alaska. And for the whole purpose of the better connecting Washington, D.C. to the field. And enabling us to be much more supportive of what's going on here in Southeast Alaska, because these issues are very complex.
During his trip to Ketchikan, Blazer met with a timber cluster group and visited a wood pellet plant in Ward Cove. He says the administration recognizes the importance of development of biomass energy in the region.
Looking at woody biomass development in this country is one of the things, one of the pieces that President Obama has in his strategy, looking at all alternative energy sources in regards to meeting the energy demands of this country. And looking at Southeast Alaska, this is a very important piece, is that utilization piece. How can we look at utilizing woody biomass to help meet the energy needs of this particular area and for the country?
The federal government has begun utilizing biomass boilers throughout the region. In Ketchikan, the Federal Building and Southeast Discovery Center have converted to biomass. The city of Ketchikan is putting a biomass boiler in its new library, which is currently under construction. As local officials have discussed converting, concerns have arisen over whether there will be enough timber production in the Tongass into the future to supply a wood pellet plant. Deputy Forest Supervisor for the Tongass, Tricia O'Connor, says there is enough woody waste with the existing mills in Southeast.
What's missing is the link between that woody waste that's at the mills and a product that people can use. In other words, there isn't a large-scale pellet manufacturer in Southeast yet. So that link is still missing, and that has to be part of the equation.
She says a timber industry, conservation groups, and government officials are working together to develop a woody biomass industry that would utilize timber from restoration projects throughout the region. Blazer says he's been impressed by the level of collaboration between user groups in the Tongass.
And that's one of the things that I've found so encouraging in the short time that I've been here, is learning of these very strong, diverse working collaboratives. As these issues are addressed on how we're going to get to where we need to be, find solutions to these gaps that are in place at this point. That has to be done in a very collaborative manner in order to get the buy-in from both the environmental community and the industry community.
Blazer is also scheduled to visit Sitka and attend the Federal Subsistence Board meeting in Juneau during his tour of the Tongass. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
Final results are in from the Alaska GOP's presidential preference poll. Mitt Romney remains the winner, narrowly defeating Rick Santorum. Santorum picked up enough votes to earn another delegate. Party Chairman Randy Riedrich says the results released following the March 6th contest did not include about 900 out-of-district ballots that were cast. Those were just counted. The results show Romney with 4,554 votes, Santorum with 4,254, Ron Paul with 3,410, and Newt Gingrich with 1,878. 24 delegates were up for grabs, allocated in proportion to the candidate's share of the vote. Santorum gained a delegate, ending with 8, the same as Romney. Paul's delegate count remained at 6. Gingrich lost a delegate and ended with 2. Additionally, 3 state party leaders will go to the national convention as unpledged. Homer mystery writer Dana Stabenow has just released the 19th novel in her Kate Chugach series. For the first time ever, the private investigator Chugach meets up with another series character of Stabenow's, Liam Campbell. Restless in the Grave begins in Afghanistan, where a young man is forced into shooting down a helicopter, and then we find ourselves in southwest Alaska. Dana wouldn't budge when I pressed for the connection between the Middle East and the remote areas of Alaska, saying it would give away too much of the mystery. But she did tell me that it started with her decision to kill off a fictional, unpopular Alaska pilot with a Super Cub. She wanted a wide suspect pool, so she quizzed a Homer pilot and a mechanic for an easy way to sabotage a plane. He suggested simply loosening a nut on an oil filter.
All you need is an open-end box wrench to do that. It'd take 5 minutes. You know, unbutton the cowling, a half a turn. He said, button it back up, walk away. He said, you could definitely get away with that. Anybody could do that. And he told me chapter and verse what would happen. And I said, how do you know this? And he looked at me with kind of a smile, and he said, because I did that myself. He didn't tighten down the nut on the filter.
Oh, no.
And it started backing up the vibration of the engine once he got into the air. Once the it started and he's gotten into the air, it started to back off on the oil filter like that and landed really quickly. So he told me, so chapter and verse, everything in the, and I'm not giving anything away because the murder has already been committed. If it is a murder, because we don't know that at first.
That's
so
great.
There's that. And then the overarching plot, including the Pakistan-Afghanistan part of the plot, is something that I thought of up on my own, and then I went in to talk to Eric Gonzalez at the FBI, which I do occasionally go talk to him about stuff. They're so great. The FBI is so great. I mean, it's not their job to help me find plots for my novels, but they've been so great in, carving out 5-10 minutes of their time. So I go in and I sit down and I run the plot by him, and he just sort of sits at me staring, pretty much white to the lips, and he said, God, Danny, he said, we're really worried about that. So I was so happy to frighten the FBI, and there was no going back. And that's where this book comes from, is from those two things. So I'm looking around the map of Alaska, as I do, because it all starts with a place, with me. And I thought, ooh, southwest Alaska. Kate's never been there. And I thought, oh, that's Liam's country. And then I went, oh.
I was going to ask about that. Liam Campbell teams up with Kate for the first time. How long has he sort of been on hiatus from his own series, and why bring him into Kate's world?
Boy, okay, you would ask me that. It's been a while. The books have been out of print for a while, long enough for the rights to revert to me, and I actually brought them back into publication as ebooks here last year. Why do it? Mostly because I could. It was hard, though. If I had known how hard it was going to be, I'm not sure. I think my heart would have failed me and I would have figured out something else. Because the two cast of characters, I'm proud to say, are both very strong, with very strong voices and very strong personalities and individuals and life, you know, lives. And trying to meld the two of them together was very difficult. And I finally had to just ask myself, okay, is this a Liam Campbell novel or is this a Kate Chugach novel? And it is a Kate Chugach novel. So the novel has to be told in Kate's voice, and it is. Which is not to say that you don't get to visit with all the Liam Campbell characters, because you pretty much do. And there are some new ones, I think, that people will enjoy. Some that I certainly enjoyed.
When people come to your stories and kind of come into Kate's house and her world, what do you want them to leave with? What are you hoping their experience is?
I hope they had a good time. I'm an entertainer. This book is, what, $25? If they don't get $25 worth of entertainment out of this book, I'm not doing my job. And I know I've said that before, but I mean it. It is what drives me. This is, I'm the guy with the bowl, a little wooden bowl at the fire, it's telling stories around the fire, hoping to get a few coins in the bowl before everybody rolls in for the night. That's me. You know, I'm heir to a long, you know, human tradition of storytelling, and we all need stories. And we all need a little R&R at the end of our days. And I'm hoping that I provide that for the people who read my books. Yeah.
Well, Dana, I almost hate to ask this next question because
oh, no, I'm scared.
No, it's because it always reminds me of after I've made some epic meal and one of the kids would say, well, so what are you making for dinner tomorrow?
Like, well, you want to know what's coming next? Oh, shoot me now. You're as bad as the fans. They get on Facebook and say, well, okay, I finished it. I loved it. When's the next one coming out? And it's like, oh, God.
All this responsibility.
I want to go fling myself into the sea or, you know, open a vein and climb into a warm tub. I'm working on the next Kate Chugach novel. I hope to have it finished by the end of April, I hope. By the end of March, actually, I'm hoping to. It should be in New York probably by June 1st, I think. I can't remember what the due date is on it. And it'll be another Kate Chugach novel. And think Romeo and Juliet.
Ooh.
Kate's going back to the park, but not to Nanilna. There's going to be something happening somewhere else.
Dana Stavenow is a New York Times best-selling fiction writer from Homer. Links to Restless in the Grave are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects, on the web at grantstation.com.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.